A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's got a personal hook to it. 10 years ago, he just arrived in Israel, went to an event where different political parties pitched themselves to voters, and that's where he met Hannah. M.K. Dov Lipman from Yesh Atid actually introduced them. The party's whole pitch was about quality of life issues, housing, cost of living, not just the usual security and religion debates. Fast forward a decade, and Daniel's watching the same problems grind on with no tenancy law, unaffordable housing, political chaos driving people out of the country, while 90% of political energy still goes to what he calls meta-issues. His question for us, how do you define a political outlook that cares about what actually improves daily life, regardless of left-right ideology? Is there a name for this? A school of thought it fits into. Something that works both inside Israeli politics and beyond it.
What I love about this prompt is that he's not asking us to solve Israeli politics. He's asking for a vocabulary, a way to name something he's been living with for a decade that feels like it should have a political home and doesn't. That's a much more interesting question.
Because pragmatic is what he reaches for, and that's not wrong, but it's also the word people use when they don't want to commit to anything. Daniel's not a non-committal guy. He's got a specific set of priorities. Tenancy law, cost of living, consumer protections, job creation, and he's willing to judge policies by their outcomes rather than their ideological pedigree. That's not mushiness. That's a positive stance.
And it's worth naming the tension at the center of this before we go anywhere else. Israeli politics is unusually good at handling existential questions, military strength, economic resilience, national identity, and a hostile region. The country has objectively succeeded at the level. But it's unusually bad at the stuff that determines whether Tuesday morning is bearable, whether your landlord can evict you on a whim, whether groceries cost a fortune, whether you can ever afford to buy an apartment. And Daniel's observation is that these aren't separate conversations. The energy that goes into the issues is energy that doesn't go into the everyday ones.
Let's unpack what this political outlook actually is, and why it feels so hard to find a home for it.
The first thing to say is that Daniel's frustration isn't just his, it's structural. And the structure starts with something very specific, how coalition politics works in Israel's proportional representation system. The electoral threshold right now is 3.25%. That was raised from 2% in 2014, and the effect was to make it harder for small parties to get into the Knesset. Which sounds like a technical detail, but it's actually the whole game. In a proportional system, you don't need to win a district. You just need to clear the national threshold, and then you get seats roughly in proportion to your vote share. At 2%, a single-issue party focused entirely on rental reform and cost of living could theoretically scrape into the Knesset with 3 or 4 seats and use them as leverage. At 3.25%, you need something like 4 seats worth of votes minimum. That's a much bigger coalition of voters. And you can't build that coalition on tenancy law alone. You need to attract people who also care about security, or religion, or national identity. So from the moment you form, you're already being pulled away from your core mission.
The threshold acts as a filter that selects against narrow-focused quality-of-life parties before they even start.
And that's just the entry barrier. Once you're in, you face the coalition dynamic. Israeli governments are almost always narrow coalitions, 61, 62 seats out of 120. That means every party in the coalition has veto power. If you're a party with 5 seats and you threaten to walk, the government collapses. So the parties that get outsized influence are the ones willing to play hardball on their specific demands. And which parties are those?
The ones with non-negotiable ideological or sectoral agendas.
The ultra-Orthodox parties care about yeshiva funding and draft exemptions. The settler right cares about settlement construction and annexation. The Arab parties, when they're in the conversation, care about Palestinian rights and community resources. These are all legitimate political priorities from their perspective, but they're also specific, defined, and non-negotiable. You can't compromise on whether yeshiva students serve in the army by splitting the difference. It's binary. So coalition negotiations become a bidding war over these binary demands, and the cross-cutting issues that affect everyone, housing, cost of living, consumer law, get whatever scraps of attention are left over.
This connects to Daniel's second point, about incompetent ministers getting portfolios. That's not a bug, it's a feature of the system.
It's the portfolio allocation problem. In a coalition government, ministries are handed out as part of the deal. The housing ministry doesn't go to the person with the best housing policy. It goes to whichever party negotiated for it, and they appoint whoever they need to reward or accommodate. You can have a housing minister who has never rented an apartment, who owns multiple properties, who has no professional background in urban planning or housing economics, and that person is now in charge of the very policies Daniel's family needs.
There's a deeper layer to this, though. It's not just that ministers are incompetent, it's that they're demographically disconnected from the problems. Daniel mentions doubting anyone in the Knesset rents property, or has moved their own moving boxes, because a landlord ended a lease. He's probably right. The average age of Knesset members is 54. Only 3 out of 120 MKs are under 40. These are people who, by and large, own their homes, have established careers, and came of age in a very different Israel. The housing crisis is an abstraction to them.
It's not just age, it's life experience. If you've never been a renter in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem in the last decade, you have no intuitive sense of what it means to have a landlord terminate your lease with 30 days' notice because they want to Airbnb the place. You don't know what it's like to move your family 3 times in 5 years because the rental market is a lawless free-for-all. Israel has no national tenancy law, no regulation on rent increases, no eviction protections, nothing at the federal level. It's one of the most unregulated rental markets in the developed world. And the people who could fix that don't feel it.
You've got 3 mechanisms reinforcing each other. The electoral threshold filters out narrow focus parties. Coalition dynamics give veto power to parties with non-negotiable ideological demands. And the people who end up in charge are structurally insulated from the problems they're supposed to solve. That's the machine. Now let's look at what happens when a party tries to break it.
Yesh Atid is the perfect case study, founded in 2012 by Yair Lapid, a former journalist and TV host. The pitch was explicitly about the middle class, reducing housing prices, cutting the cost of living, ending the draft exemptions for the ultra-Orthodox. It was a quality of life party that also had a position on the religion and state issue, which is part of why it could clear the threshold. In the 2013 election, it won 19 seats. Second largest party in the Knesset. Daniel and Hannah met at a Yesh Atid event. Dov Lipman, who introduced them, was one of the party's MKs, an American-born rabbi who'd made Aliyah and was known for his work on religious pluralism and cost of living issues. They joined the coalition. And within months, Lapid was finance minister, which sounds like a win for a party focused on economic issues. But the coalition agreement forced him to negotiate over yeshiva budgets and settlement construction. The party's original mandate got diluted by the very issues it had tried to sidestep. By the 2015 election, Yesh Atid dropped to 11 seats. It had gone from a movement to just another party in the scrum.
The system ate it.
The system ate it. And that's not because Lapid was a bad politician. He's still around. He's been prime minister briefly in one of the rotation governments. But the party's original identity as the voice of the squeezed middle class got subsumed. You can't be the housing affordability party and the security party and the religion and state party all at once without losing focus. And focus is exactly what Daniel's outlook demands.
That's the trap. To get into the Knesset, you need to be broad enough to clear the threshold. To govern, you need to take positions on everything. But the whole point of Daniel's pragmatism is that it doesn't want to take positions on everything. It wants to fix the things that are making daily life unlivable and leave the ideological battles to people who care about them.
Which brings us to the question of what this outlook actually is. Daniel calls it pragmatic, and we said that's not wrong, but it's insufficient. Let me try to give it some intellectual scaffolding. There's a tradition in political philosophy called consequentialism, the idea that the morality of an action is judged by its outcomes, not its intentions or its alignment with abstract principles. In politics, that translates to something like, judge a policy by what it actually does to human welfare, not by whether it fits your ideological framework.
Daniel is a consequentialist about housing policy.
He doesn't care if rent control was invented by socialists or if deregulation was championed by libertarians. He cares whether his family can afford to live somewhere and not get evicted on short notice. That's outcome-oriented politics. And there are existing labels that get close to this. Pragmatic centrism is one, but centrism implies splitting the difference between left and right, which isn't what he's doing. He's not looking for the midpoint between two ideologies. He's looking for the policy that works, regardless of where it came from.
Quality of life liberalism gets closer. In the classical sense, liberalism is a philosophy that prioritizes individual welfare and freedom from arbitrary power, which a landlord with unlimited eviction rights definitely represents. But liberalism has so much baggage now, especially in Israeli politics, where it's associated with specific positions on the Palestinian conflict and the judiciary.
I think the most precise term might be outcome-oriented politics. It's not ideologically neutral. It has a clear value commitment to measurable improvements in human welfare. It just doesn't care which team claims credit. And it has a built-in skepticism toward political energy that goes into symbolic battles while material conditions deteriorate.
I like that. It also explains why Daniel feels like a spectator. If your political priority is outcomes, and the system is designed to produce symbolic victories for ideological camps, you're watching a game you didn't sign up to play.
That feeling of spectatorship, that's not a personal failing. It's a rational response to a system that doesn't represent your interests. Daniel describes watching parties unite and divide over petty rivalries while incompetent ministers get portfolios, and he's right that this looks like a high school. But high school dynamics emerge when the stakes are social status within a closed system rather than material outcomes in the real world. The Knesset is a closed system. The real-world consequences of housing policy are felt by people outside it.
Those are the mechanisms. But what are the real-world consequences? Not just for Daniel, but for the country as a whole.
The most striking one is immigration. Daniel mentions that many of the immigrants who arrived when he did have since left. That's not anecdotal. Israel's Central Bureau of Statistics data shows that net migration among non-Orthodox Jews aged 25 to 44 has been negative since 2018. These are exactly the people who would benefit most from tenancy reform and cost of living policies. Young families, professionals, the tax base, and they're leaving.
Because the level of success of the country doesn't pay the rent.
Israel can have a strong military, a thriving tech sector, a resilient economy, and none of that matters if you can't afford an apartment and your landlord can evict you on a whim. The people leaving aren't fleeing existential threats. They're fleeing the accumulated exhaustion of a system that makes everyday life harder than it needs to be, while the political class argues about things that don't affect their Tuesday.
This creates a self-reinforcing loop. The people most affected by quality of life issues disengage from politics or leave the country entirely. That reduces electoral pressure to address those issues, which means the ideological parties face even less competition for political energy, which means quality of life issues get even less attention. The system doesn't just fail to solve the problem. It actively selects for people who don't experience the problem.
That's the vicious cycle. And it's not unique to Israel, which is part of what makes Daniel's question about transcending the Israeli context so interesting. Let me draw a comparison to the United States. In a two-party system, you don't get to vote for a housing affordability party. You vote Democrat or Republican, and both parties bundle housing policy with a dozen other positions you might or might not agree with. If you care about rent control and you also care about immigration restriction, there's no party for you. You have to choose which issue to prioritize, and housing usually loses to the culture war issue of the moment.
Both systems fail the pragmatic quality of life voter, just in different ways. The multi-party system creates coalition paralysis, where narrow ideological parties have veto power. The two-party system forces you to bundle your preferences in the packages designed by party elites. Neither gives you a way to say, I just want my housing costs to be reasonable and my lease to be stable.
There have been attempts to break this. The Pirate Party in Germany is an instructive example. In the 2011 Berlin state election, they won 8.9% of the vote on a single-issue platform. Digital rights, internet freedom, transparency. They didn't take positions on tax policy or foreign affairs. They just said, this one thing matters, and we're going to make it our entire political identity. And it worked for about 5 years. By 2016, they'd collapsed due to internal divisions and pressure to broaden their platform. The system demanded they become a real party, with positions on everything, and they couldn't do that without losing what made them distinctive. And in Israel, there was an attempt in 2019 to form a renters' party, focused on housing and tenancy reform. They couldn't even gather enough signatures to register. The structural barriers to entry are that high.
If forming a party is a dead end, and the existing parties are captured by issues, what does Daniel actually do? Given all this, what can someone who feels politically homeless actually do? Let's get practical.
The first thing is to name the problem correctly, because naming it changes how you approach it. If you think the problem is, I haven't found the right party, you keep shopping for parties and getting disappointed. If you understand that the problem is structural, the system is designed to deprioritize your concerns, then you stop looking for a party to save you and start thinking about leverage.
Leverage from outside the system.
The most effective quality of life improvements in recent history haven't come from political parties. They've come from tenant unions, consumer advocacy groups, municipal politics, housing cooperatives. These operate at a level where the structural distortions are weaker. A city council member in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem is much more likely to be affected by the rental crisis than a Knesset member. Local politics has its own dysfunctions, but the feedback loop between policy and daily life is shorter.
There's a historical model for this. The labor movement didn't start with a political party. It started with unions organizing at the workplace level. The environmental movement didn't start with green parties. It started with local activism and direct action. Political parties came later, and in many cases, they diluted the movements they were supposed to represent.
The strategy Daniel might consider is not finding a political home, but building pressure from outside. Tenant unions in Israel are underdeveloped compared to places like Berlin or New York, but they exist. There are organizations working on housing rights. There are municipal elections where a few thousand votes can actually shift policy. These aren't as glamorous as national politics, but they're where the material conditions of daily life actually get negotiated.
I think there's a psychological shift here, too. Daniel describes feeling like a spectator. Part of what makes spectatorship so frustrating is the sense that you should be able to participate, but the system won't let you. Recognizing that the system is structurally designed to exclude your concerns, that it's not a personal failure, it's a feature, can be liberating. It means you stop expecting the Knesset to care about your lease and start looking for power where power actually exists.
There's another dimension to this that's worth naming. Daniel's outlook isn't just a reaction to broken systems, it's a coherent political philosophy with a long intellectual pedigree. The idea that government should be judged by its effects on ordinary life, rather than its alignment with grand narratives, goes back to the pragmatist philosophers, William James, John Dewey. Dewey in particular argued that democracy isn't just a procedure for choosing leaders, it's a method for solving collective problems. When the procedure stops solving problems, it's not functioning as democracy, regardless of how many elections you hold.
That's a bracing standard. By that measure, a lot of what passes for democratic politics is theater.
It's theater with real consequences for the actors, but not for the audience. And Daniel's sitting in the audience watching the drama and thinking, none of this affects whether my landlord can evict me.
We've named the problem and sketched a strategy, but there's one big question we haven't answered. Can a political system that prioritizes quality of life over ideology actually survive in a region where existential threats are real? Daniel acknowledges this. He's not naive. He knows Israel needs a strong military. But his point is that the country has succeeded at the level while failing at the everyday level. The question is whether that's a stable equilibrium. Can you have a strong country full of miserable people?
That's the tension. And historically, the answer is, for a while, yes. Empires have maintained military dominance while their populations suffered. But eventually, the material conditions catch up. When the people who pay taxes and serve in the reserves and run the economy start leaving because they can't afford to live, the level of success becomes unsustainable. The military needs a tax base. The economy needs workers. The country needs people who want to stay.
This isn't just an Israeli problem. Housing costs and tenancy instability are worsening globally. In the US, the UK, Canada, Australia, more and more voters in more and more democracies are going to face Daniel's dilemma. A political system that's obsessed with ideological battles while their material conditions deteriorate. Israel is just a concentrated preview of something that's spreading.
Which makes Daniel's search for a label more than a personal exercise. Outcome-oriented politics, or whatever we end up calling it, is going to be one of the defining political identities of the next decade. People who are tired of being asked to care about symbolic battles while their rent goes up and their lease gets terminated. People who want to judge policies by what they do, not what they signal.
The final thing I'd say to Daniel is this. The act of naming the problem is itself political. When you stop accepting the menu of options the system gives you and start articulating what you actually want, you're doing something. You're creating a position that doesn't currently have representation. That's how new political identities form. Not by finding the right existing party, but by naming a need that isn't being met and finding others who share it.
The label matters because it lets people find each other. If you call yourself politically homeless, you're describing a feeling. If you call yourself an outcome-oriented voter, you're describing a standard. And standards can organize around.
To Daniel's question, what school of political thought does this resonate with? I'd say it's a form of pragmatism in the philosophical sense, with a strong dose of classical liberalism's concern for individual welfare and freedom from arbitrary power. But it's also something newer, something that's emerging in response to the specific dysfunctions of 21st century democracy. It doesn't have a perfect name yet. Maybe naming it is part of what we're doing here.
If I were to give one piece of practical advice, it would be, stop looking for a party that represents this. Start looking for other people who feel it. The party comes later, if it comes at all. The organizing comes first.
We've named the problem, traced the mechanisms, and sketched a way forward. The open question, and I think this is the one Daniel will be sitting with, is whether the structural forces we described are actually changeable, or whether they're so deeply embedded that the only viable strategy is to build parallel systems outside of formal politics entirely. Mutual aid networks, tenant unions that operate regardless of who's in government. That's a bigger conversation, and probably one for another time.
I'd add that this conversation isn't just for Israelis. If you're listening in London or Toronto or Sydney and you feel like your political system is obsessed with culture war symbolism while your rent keeps going up, you're not alone and you're not crazy. The structure is the problem, not you.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1980s, meteorologists widely accepted a theory that katabatic winds in Tierra del Fuego were the primary driver of Antarctic ice sheet formation, channeling cold air down the Andes with such force that they essentially air-conditioned the entire Southern Ocean. The theory collapsed when researchers realized they had been measuring wind speeds with anemometers that iced over and gave wildly inflated readings.
The Southern Ocean was being air-conditioned by faulty equipment.
An entire theory built on frozen wind gauges. That feels like a metaphor for something, but I'm not sure what.
This has been my weird prompts. If you've got a weird prompt you want us to explore, political philosophy, housing crises, frozen anemometers, whatever it is, email the show@myweirdprompts.com. We're Korn and Herman Poppleberry, and we'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.